All right. What's up, listeners? I got some good and some bad news for you today. Good news is that I got a real microphone. Check it out. The bad news is that it's not actually going to be featured in this episode. But what you will hear is a great interview with Stephanie Feldman, who is a co-founder of Six Reasons, a venture building agency. So we're going to talk about how she got started in entrepreneurship, her experience in launching a venture building company, and we're going to zone in into one of her ventures where she had to do quite a major pivot. So we're going to talk all about that. It's going to be great. So yeah, you're really going to enjoy this episode. Stick around for the end. It's really fun. Yeah, so thanks, Chevy, for coming on the podcast. We're looking forward to having you on and hearing what you have to say.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I guess we can start it with some of your first inklings that you were interested in entrepreneurship. Like, what were some of your earliest memories around that?
Funny story, actually. I think the first time I saw that I had some kind of entrepreneurial motivation in me while in primary school. Back then all of us used to collect this around this mouse, little mouse it was called. So they had postcards, etc., all sorts of things, stuffed animals as well. And one of the things that we all collected was notepad pieces of paper where they had printed mouse pictures on them. And I came across two very rare ones. And then started to play around with my dad's copying machine and figured out that I can actually make pretty nice and pretty decent and authentic copies of those two rare notepads, pieces of paper, and started selling them at school. I think that was my first entrepreneurial experience. It later on led to CDs I burned for friends, etc. So I started my business activities quite early. Not necessarily legally. I didn't know back then, though. But yeah, I think those were the first times.
How old were you?
With the notepad thing, that was primary school. So that was third grade. I was 9.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And already from university, I believe you launched your first company, Six Reasons.
What was the
experience like?
I never planned. At that point, I didn't have in mind that I was going to be a founder. So that one happened by accident, more or less. So I had just finished my bachelor's thesis and got the results back, which said that I actually failed my thesis. That's a very long story. But so, yeah, I had failed my thesis. I'd already had a master's spot in Dublin for international management. So I had rented out my apartment again. I sold all of my furniture. And then it turns out, okay, crap, I'm going to have to do this all over again, or I'm going to just have to drop out. Those were the two possible ways I could go. And in that time, one of my very best friends started his second company, actually, but just started a new one. And since I didn't have anything much to do anyways, and I had to wait another 6 months before I could start the bachelor's thesis again, I said, I'm going to help him out. So I'm going to see what I can do there and get involved in the startup. And that was Six Reasons. And that's how I ended up founding my first company. That was more by accident than really planned, to be honest.
So when you first joined Six Reasons, this new company, what was your role there and how did it evolve over time?
So the company evolved over time plus my role. When we first started, apart from Six Reasons, we had an idea for a music app that we wanted to develop. And for that, obviously, none of us had money. Most of us were still enrolled at university. But we saw that we have someone on the team that can code. We have someone that does design. Me, who has a background in marketing, which was my initial role as well, plus a more business sales person. And we started selling agency services, basically. So we were part of this LMU, Ludwig Maximilians Universität, entrepreneurship center here in Munich. So we got the infrastructure there, we got the office there, etc. But what we did get as well is access to lots of big corporates in and around Munich. And we sold them all sorts of digital services. So from building websites to apps to conducting workshops, actually, filming videos, tutorials, etc. for them. We did anything really to earn some money and then be able to get a few working students on board and in parallel develop our music app, which eventually we figured out wasn't feasible from a technical perspective back then. But yeah, that's how Six Reasons started. So it was more of a like a bootstrapping, making money machine agency in the beginning. And I was in charge of the marketing activities for ourselves as well as for customers.
Cool. And how was that bootstrapping a company? I guess it must be quite a journey as well.
Yeah, it is. So Six Reasons we used to bootstrap everything that came afterwards. So the first project and the first idea that we had was this music app. But we did have multiple more venture ideas. And in the very early stages, we never wanted to get external investment involved, especially for like trying to validate if there's a business case, if there's actually a demand on the market, etc. So we used Six Reasons as our bootstrapping machine. Which evolved eventually, not just as a bootstrapping machine for us, but as a venture builder for our customers. So we started to sell the whole process of venture building and what we did on the side as one of our service products that we sold to corporates in Munich and around. It was bootstrapping on one side, but it was also venture building on the other side, which was a very nice mixture. All of that was, I have to say, 2013, 2014, which was very early days in terms of venture building and processes around that, etc. Bootstrapping in our case was more like an agency business. So it wasn't like a fixed amount of money that you had in the beginning. And then you try to make it last as long as possible, but it was more of a cash flow situation and planning. So it's a bit different compared to, I'd say, other standalone one-off ventures that bootstrap themselves.
Yeah, so Six Reasons started as an agency, and then you said you moved into venture building. Why did you decide to go in that direction?
Well, two reasons really why we had it move in that direction. On the one side, we saw a demand in the market, so we saw that many companies were back then were starting their first accelerator programs and incubation programs, etc., and wanted to experiment around venture building and startups. They did not know anything about what it means and how the processes look like. So they didn't know where to invest, what to do, how to do it. There were lots of like design thinking workshops and stuff like that happening. So there was a huge demand on the market. Plus, we had developed our own process by then. At least the first draft of it, based on literature that's out there from Lean Startup to whatever you name it, combined with our own experience. So we built, I would say, on average, probably two ventures a year with a fixed team. In total, I think it was 11 ventures that we built throughout the years. Five of them were just internal ones, so just our own ventures where we didn't have any company or any clients involved, and actually exited a few as well. So we combined the experience with the theoretical process that was starting to get established back then. And
And you did all of it in-house, or did you have some other agencies help you, like subcontracting for these projects?
Both. So I would say 80% we did in-house. We worked with lots of working students back then. Quickly learned that a workforce made out of working students alone would not get you too far. And we grew the internal team up to roughly 15 to 20 people, and then added some external partners as well. So there was another like similar agency type of thing starting in Munich as well. We shared an office. That was one of our ventures, was a co-working space in Munich. they were part of that co-working space as well, so we cooperated with them. And then for the development part of most of our projects, which it was mainly apps and websites and integrations, etc., we involved an offshore agency in Romania as well, because one of my co-founders is Romanian, so he handled the product ownership of that and the communication. So we worked together with them.
So when you build, what was your agreement with some of these, your clients? What were your engagements like? Were you committing to a certain number of ventures per year, or was it a lot of one-off projects? What was your kind of relationship with them?
All of them were only one-off projects up front. So we never sold a whole bundle of ventures that we were going to build. In terms of the contract and how it looked like, it varied a lot. So sometimes they were shareholder of this venture when we actually founded the entity, and they invested a certain amount of money into that entity, and we used that to build the product. That was one of the cases. Another one would have been they just paid for our services and the rest was up to us. Plus they would have like the first basically dips on the company if we ever decided to sell it. That was another variety of the conditions that we had. So it was, there was no predefined package that we sold to corporates. It was always up to negotiations.
With the MVP development, I mean, do you do that we do 6 months development period, or do you, let's say, do 1 month development, then you check, test it with the users, or what's the process there for you?
Again, excluding cybersecurity, all of the other ventures, I would say a maximum of 2 months development time probably. And then we went on to testing it straight away and then iterating on it. Very lean approach on how to do it, how to solve it. Cybersecurity, again, very different, because there's just no, it's very hard to define an MVP when it comes to cybersecurity and personal data. There's not a lot of compromises that you can actually do and ignore things for an MVP. But for all of the other ventures, very straightforward, 1 to 2 months development cycles until we release the latest version and tested it.
And how do you get these first customers? You know, once you release it into the market, do you do sort of online sales or marketing? And what is sort of the approach you do?
Again, highly depends on the venture. So for insurance, we cooperated with, from our perspective, multipliers. So we cooperated, one of the products that we sold online was pet insurance. So we cooperated with the big online pet stores and other pet specific places where our customers would be. And they integrated our solution there. And then they basically sold it for us. So we didn't have to generate the traffic ourselves. For the dating thing, which was B2C as well, we did use Facebook in the beginning, which was our Facebook ads, which was our most successful channel, until Facebook decided it doesn't allow ads from dating services apart from match.com anymore. Then we had to change our approach and actually changed our product. It really depends on the kind of venture that you're building. What kind of target group do you want to, or do you need to address? Where are they? How can you get to them? And what's the cheapest way to convert them?
Yeah, that brings up a question about pivoting. How do you know, for example, with the dating service, when to shut down or when to look at different business models or opportunities? How do you make that call?
I think if you're very process-driven and if it's an venture build for one of your clients, you're always you're looking closely at the data and at the numbers. So that does tell you quite fast whether it's working out or not. So do you actually convert users? Do you actually make money, or whatever the main unit is that you want to measure? For internal, for our own ventures, there's lots of ideology involved. There's lots of Like, it feels like your baby. So you don't necessarily look at the numbers too closely, or you don't believe them. And that often leads to many months spent on further developing ventures where it just doesn't make sense. So the way you normally look at is, how big is the market? Does it make sense to address it? Can I actually address this? Can I reach the target audience with very limited resources and very limited money? And if I can't, I need to change something. But there's the problem. Oftentimes you don't really measure it. You don't see the reality. We see the, like, your vision. And obviously for you, it makes so much sense to go that way. You don't even believe the numbers. And then you realize way too late that you should have pivoted early on, or you should have stopped early on. But in general, I would say, look at the numbers, ideally at the beginning. Is the market big enough? Can you address it? How do you address it? And always track all of the numbers that are relevant.
So in one of your ventures, you actually had a pretty hard pivot from dating, like we're mentioning, to cybersecurity. How did you guys make that decision to pivot or shut it down and say, you know, something's not working? And specifically with Keep, that's a big change to a whole different industry.
Yeah. Like, how was that process within your team? And how did you decide to go there instead of just shutting it down altogether?
The first, we actually pivoted twice now. The first pivot from dating app to the infrastructure, which was a huge one. There were only us founders involved, so that was comparably easy. So none of us really had to change anything. We had an investor involved for that as well. He was one of the main drivers for the pivot. So he had lots of insights from the cybersecurity world, etc. We did those solution interviews first of all, and then tried to write down the theory of a product and what it would look like for that very specific industry. So huge corporates all of a sudden, plus their security department. And then we talked to them. So we straight up called them, tried to do sales, B2B sales, and that kind of size was new to us as well. But we, through our investor and through our own network, we got in contact with the big corporates, had lots of workshops, lots of meetings with them. And that's what helped us shape the product as well. So in the beginning, we sold something very, very different from what it was in the end. But always try and get the input from the people involved in your customer group, because they're going to tell you what they need. They know their market and like their area a lot more than you ever will. So try and listen to them and then try and see how you can change your product. And that was then eventually the first pivot. It's nothing that happens overnight. It's like a constant process. But yeah, at that part for us, it was easy. A later stage where we changed the product again was very different, because that meant we had to change the whole team setup. So we suddenly didn't have the need for various job positions anymore, meaning that we actually had to let go people, and a lot of people, which was very difficult. So that was a very different pivot compared to the first one, because the first one didn't really have any personal implications. The second one did, definitely.
That must be very tough as well. I mean, how do you handle that, you know, letting go of a lot of people?
It's nothing that you actually learn at university, do you? So it's very difficult. So as a founder, you always wear at least two hats at the same time. The one is you're the shareholder and responsible for the business. The other hat is you as a person and as an employee of the company. And that switch is sometimes a bit schizophrenic and sometimes very weird. We read up, so that was the decision that we made, I think, over 2 weeks. So we had 2 weeks of time where we had to decide, okay, where are we going to move with this company? What does it mean? Who of the people do we actually need to let go? what does the cash flow look like, etc. And then me and my co-founder set up the meeting. So it was one-on-one meetings on one day with every single one, no matter if we let them go or not, and updated them on the current situation, and then actually had to have the talk, which we prepared for in theory based on stuff that we read online, like pseudo psychological stuff. And I think the rest is just empathy. I mean, you know the people well, you know how to phrase things, and 90% of them understood completely, which was great, which was brilliant. But some were not so great, which is understandable as well, but didn't necessarily make it easier for us.
Were you part of the hiring team, or were you responsible for evaluating people that joined the ventures you helped start? And how did you find the people to take the risk and join this new startup?
I was always involved when it came to hiring all of us founders. In the later stages, when we had a bigger team, that was just, we were all just partially involved, depending on what type of job the person would do. So are you directly involved with them or not? For me, it was marketing, communications, operations, etc. But in the beginning, all of us were involved. And it's always a big struggle to try and find good people, especially once you go into like areas of young professionals and experts. You certainly can't offer the kind of money and the kind of compensation that big corporates offer. Being here in Munich, it's Google, it's BMW, etc. that you're competing with. So that's ridiculous. You know that you can't ever compete with them. What you can do is, or what you need to do is, this is now from a marketing perspective, is sell your idea and your brand and your vision, and get them motivated to join forces and to actually want to achieve the same goal. This helps a lot, and I think is the most important thing, to get motivated people as well. But in terms of compensation, etc., it's very hard. What you can do is offer, they're called ESOP and VSOP, which is employee like virtual stock options that you can offer to your employees, depending on when they joined, etc. That helps. That is nice, especially if it's a case that is like a classical VC case that has the aim of an exit at one point, because only then obviously it makes sense to actually hold shares in the company. That helps too. But I think that's the only mechanism that you can use in terms of compensation.
Did you end up hiring any friends or family? I know you're part of a lot of startup communities here, so I'm sure you probably knew a lot of people that were highly qualified. How did that work out?
We did. But first of all, parts of the founder team were friends, so we started like that. We did eventually hire friends as well, never family, I think, but friends. That worked out well. It has lots of positive sides, obviously. But I was talking about having to let go people earlier, and that involved lots of the friends as well, which did not make it easier. So one of the people that I actually had to let go is my flatmate. That is a very tricky situation. You learn a lot in that process. It has positive sides and it's great and you get along straight away. But if times get rougher, or if you don't agree, and not on a personal level, but like on a professional level, it makes things a lot more complicated. So I'm not sure if I would necessarily do that again.
How did you balance that, you know, work and life, since, you know, your friends were also colleagues sometimes?
This work-life balance thing. I'm pretty sure if you're talking to most founders out there, they will tell you this is bullshit. Because it's not that you don't want to have a life, but the definition of work-life balance is so tricky, and it separates two things. And in theory, following that, you should be able to, in your brain, separate two different worlds, which in practice does not work. So whenever I have a good idea for my business and it's a Saturday, yeah, I will write it down, or I will do something with it. So I will have to work on something. So work-life balance as a founder is probably not really doable, to be honest, like not in the theoretical definition of the idea. The great thing is that you can choose at what point you want to work and what point you just don't and want to sleep or something. But as soon as you interact with people and talk about what you do, and obviously you do that, you get inputs, and then you automatically work. So it's very tricky. And yeah, I would say there's no work-life balance in general, but yeah, looking at that and that specific situation, no, there's no separation, and you don't even want to separate it. Most of the times, working doesn't really feel like work if it's your own idea, and if you do it because it's fun and you actually like doing it, then you don't need to have this like separate 4-hour time slot of I am not allowed to work now. This idea is very stressful for me, at least. So yeah.
Cool. Since you've been now working on many, many ventures over the years, you know, what are the biggest learnings you've made that you could sort of share with first time founders?
Ooh, many learnings. First time founders. Okay. Don't try and over engineer something in theory before you've actually talked to one of your customers. That's, I think, one of the main learnings, that if you follow it, would save you a lot of time. Because if you have a business idea, you get lost in the idea and you get lost in the details, and you see so many more possibilities suddenly and so many more markets, etc. And don't, at that point, don't even know if it's feasible and if there's a need for it. So I think I would always start there. Plus, don't get external investment earlier than you have to, because that always means you lose shares. And that always means the point where you have, if you continue raising funds, that means you have less than 50% of the shares earlier than you should. That always depends on the situation, obviously, but be careful there. Plus, when you found the company, do like the entity itself, from a legal perspective, think what your plan is with that company and then set it up accordingly, because there are so many different ways to do that. And there might be a right way and a wrong way for you to set up your entity. And if you do it the right way, it will save you a lot of time and a lot of money in the future as well.
So you're part of a lot of startup communities today, helping a lot of small businesses keep growing and yeah, kind of sharing your wisdom and building companies. What's your big motivator there? What energizes you to be part of all these initiatives and communities?
It's a very good question. I think I like to see people evolving and people getting ahead faster than they would have on their own. So if I can share something that actually helps them, I love that. That's brilliant. On the other side, entrepreneurship in general is something that needs to be pushed. I'd love to see more people risking it and going out there and actually giving it a try, instead of like the traditional being an employee way. So I like seeing people take risks. Where I'm mostly involved is everything that concerns female entrepreneurship. So I want to see more women found their own companies. That's why I'm very motivated to support that.
Very cool. Nice. Do you have sort of a toolkit that you often use when you do something building companies? Like, do you have certain frameworks or a certain set of questions you always ask yourself that you may want to share with the listeners?
Yeah, so I think the frameworks, they're nothing new. So the frameworks are design thinking, conducting interviews, researching the markets, and the, I would say, the classic lean startup approach. Set of questions. I actually recently shared this with a friend. She has a vague business idea or a vague idea for something where she sees potential and just didn't know where to start. So I sent her through this whole set of questions, which was basically, okay, what kind of problem are you trying to solve? That is something that often gets lost somewhere. So you focus too much on the solution. So what's the actual problem? Who is your target group? So who has that problem? And trying to actually describe the persona, not just like a vague, okay, big corporates have this problem. No, who inside the corporate has this problem? So who's your stakeholder? How could a solution to that look like once you actually talk to the potential target group? You draft, it can be just written, you draft a solution that would actually solve this problem, and then you start prototyping that and testing it again. So it's always about talking to people, testing it, getting feedback. I think that's the most important thing.
What did you have for lunch though? You have to write down that.
I know, I was wondering as well.
I had leftovers from last night's dinner. So that was baked sweet potato with like a feta cheese sour cream thing dip and some salad. That's really nice.
Well, thank you very much. And also, where can our listeners connect with you online?
Anywhere really. So apart from Xing, I think I'm everywhere. So Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram. Email. No, no email, please.
Cool.
Great. Again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. We really hope you enjoyed it. Our captivating theme song is The Vendetta by Stefan Kartenberg. If you want to connect with us or send a guest recommendation, drop us a line at launch.learn@gmail.com or connect with Matthias or myself on LinkedIn. Have a great one and see you next time on Launch and Learn.